Hello there, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Asian American Studies. I'm Jason Koh, and my guest today is Chris Patterson, your usual host, who is an assistant professor at Hong Kong Baptist University in the Department of Humanities and Creative Writing. Chris also writes fiction under his alter ego, Kavika Guillermo. Today, we'll discuss his academic book, Transitive Cultures, Anglophone Literature of the Trans-Pacific, which was published by Rutgers University Press. Chris Patterson's book, Transitive Cultures, compares English language literary production from Southeast Asia and its diasporas in North America in order to elucidate and critique discourses of pluralist governance. Building upon established arguments that state-sponsored multiculturalism at home justifies imperialism abroad, and that state-assigned ethnic and national identities in Southeast Asia are vestiges of colonialism, Patterson studies minor literatures of the Trans-Pacific as a mode of response to pluralist governmentality. In examining these cultural communities, he finds an, quote, alternative politics of identity in their literature that express a motif of transition. Engaging in these ceaseless processes of transition, which Patterson dubs transitive cultures, enables individuals to maintain mobility in hyper-controlled spaces. Instead of using a national paradigm such as Asian American literature, Patterson uses the term Trans-Pacific Anglophone literature to describe English language texts from Malaysia, Singapore, and the Philippines, as well as those written by Southeast Asian migrants to Hawaii, Canada, and the mainland United States. He uses this label to emphasize the encounter and exchange that typifies transitive culture, and to stress the ideology of linguistic identities. This genealogy of an underappreciated literary tradition explores transitive cultures in metahistorical novels, travel narratives, and in non-realist genres, and offers a border-crossing method for conceptualizing and reading literature that purposefully elides multicultural categorizations. Hi, Christopher.
Hi.
Well, let's get into it. How did you start down this research path?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on, for agreeing to host this. So what started me down the path was my upbringing I was born in Portland, Oregon, and my family was my mother was from Hawaii, and my sister was also born in Hawaii, and so they were also quite mixed, and my family in general was very mixed, in the sense that there's blackness in my family, there's white people, there's Japanese, my auntie is Japanese, there's a lot of Filipinos, there's my Chinese little cousins, I have a Korean sister-in-law. And so there's this kind of this playful attitude towards intimacy, crossover, and identity that I felt like was always kind of ingrained in just the way I was brought up. But the thing is, though, all those identities, at least from in Hawaii, all kind of cohere under this kind of local identity, right? And then the Hawaiian sun turns every skin brown, in a sense, the same kind of color brown. And so when we moved to Portland, it was different. Like when I was born, we couldn't just say we were locals anymore, right? And so we've kind of gone through this strange process of mixture. And then suddenly everyone else had kind of more to say about who we were than we did.
Right.
And so it was kind of that experience of growing up that way, of being in a very kind of working class communities. And then when my mother divorced my father, she still had three kids, to take care of. And so kind of just seeing her and my older sister and the way that they dealt with race and with the way people saw them, gender and sexuality, was always, it always felt like they were experts on themselves, right? But everyone who talked to them felt like they were experts on them. And so there was kind of this strange game always being played, and I could observe how well they played it,
Right.
And so my mother's kind of like an expert at her own, living in her own body and performing herself. And so that kind of inspired a lot of the book, like being able to see that the way my family adjusts to that, the way that they move from one space to another. And so that's where a lot of the ideas from the book started to come from. That's where I first started to question. And so, yeah, and how does that then work in a larger context? Why does that seem to be similar in the way it works, whether I'm in Hawaii or living in China, or living in America,
right?
Why do we still have to bump up with those same boxes, or boxes but differently named boxes?
Right.
Yeah.
How did you? What type of tactics did you see your family elders partaking in?
It was really difficult to understand at the time, and I think reading a lot of literature helped articulate or at least help me characterize what I was seeing a bit more. And, you know, like the book doesn't talk about my family at all, because I feel like that at least other people can kind of see the literature and understand it. And so, yeah, I didn't even quite understand what I was seeing, right? Because to me, it was like, you know, my sister is sometimes Black, sometimes she's Latino, sometimes she's this, you know, and I thought about those in kind of a, I wouldn't say naive, but not very developed, you know, not very academic way or not very articulated way. But then the more literature I read, the more like Asian American literature, literature in English from Southeast Asia, literature from Hawaii, I started to realize this is not, you know, people have a hard time recognizing this, but there's a lot of books about it.
Right.
And a lot of times these books are not the kind of typical canonical books that you would imagine is like, you know, in an American literature class or even an ethnic literature class. And so I became very interested in trying to answer those questions via literary texts. And especially the ones that are kind of on the margins, right? The ones that are deemed inauthentic,
right?
Or too kind of trickstery or not about an authentic ethnic subjectivity, right? So those texts really started to attract me, seduce me much more than the ones that we were kind of more plainly given and said, you know, this is a book that's about you and your identity.
So how did you go about finding these texts?
I would credit the great process of graduate school. And, you know, I had like over 200 books on my exams list when I was doing my exams.
Wow.
And so, you know, that makes you read the marginal books.
Right.
You know, if there's anything to be said about that, you can at least say I've read more than the canon. I've actually read all around the canon I think my exam list was like migrant diasporic literature or something like that. And those were the only terms that we had to name them. And so, I ended up reading a lot, just based on those exams lists and then realizing, similarities that I couldn't see before and that I hadn't learned about in any class thus far.
Well, that is an interesting point and part of the critical intervention of your book. You know, how do people find these texts if they don't necessarily fit into that category, especially if these books are about escaping or, you know, or using categories. So maybe you could tell us more about this title, this idea of transitive culture and, you know, what does that mean? And the specific idea of trans-Pacific Anglophone literature.
Yeah. For transitive culture first. And I get this idea from a lot of these texts, so it's really hard to explain it without conjuring them.
Right.
I mean, the kind of one word or one sentence definition I give is that they're transitive cultures are cultural practices of managing, reinterpreting, and transitioning among cultural identities and focusing on contexts where identities are seen as authentic. And so that's the kind of one sentence version. But when I think about it and I try to explain it, usually I have to. It takes these particular texts because they're so unique and the context that they're dealing with are also so unique. And so, like in the book, I talk about K.S. Manium's In a Far Country, where he talks about the tiger as a metaphor. And the tiger is kind of symbolizes, I guess, in an American context, it would symbolize like ethnic nationalism.
Right.
And so the tiger is, you know, the strong, empowered being who protects its young. Right. So it's about preservation and it's about kind of entrenchment, right? And
right.
You know, tiger staying in the tree or in the cave or something. And then Manium basically contrasts that in a later essay with the figure of the chameleon. And so the chameleon is kind of the you know, opposite in some ways to the tiger, still kind of an ethnic migrant subject, but one who adapts to whatever environment's put in, and can often be read in different ways all at the same time.
Right.
So it's not just switching from one thing to another. It's simultaneously many things. And so Manium then talks about how the chameleon is actually more upsetting for him to the optics of racialism in Malaysia at the time. And so in the early 90s, whereas, you know, I think from the U.S. point of view, we'd kind of immediately assume it's the tiger is the most resistant, the most upsetting figure. But for Manium, it's in an a context of kind of multiculturalism or multiracialism, the chameleon is actually more upsetting in that sense because they can't be tied down.
Right.
You know, and that upsets the system, that freaks right. people out.
Right.
Right. And it also rejects this idea that we should be kind of afraid of each other, that we are adversaries from one group to another, that right. we contrast each other.
Right.
You know, so I mean, that's the example I give in my book, and I think that's a good one that I keep going back to.
It is a really great example.
Yeah.
Because you can't describe the chameleon. What color is a chameleon? Whereas it's so easy to pick out a tiger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't give itself to being described on our terms.
Right.
Once we think we know what it is. Yeah. I mean, the other big inspiration, I think, for a lot of the book that I don't talk about in the book, that I guess I could talk about here, was Viet Nguyen's first book, Race and Resistance, which is, I picked up that book when I was an undergraduate. And I had very little interest, actually, in Asian American studies when I picked it up. And then after that book, that did a lot for me, partially because it was the first Asian American studies or book that I read that I really saw myself in, I suppose. And so he starts that book talking about two types of authors, similar to the tiger and the chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about the first two kind of big Asian American, Asian Canadian authors, the Eaton sisters. So the Edith Eaton, the kind of tigery sister, and she's the one who, I mean, they're both mixed race. They're both Eurasian at the time, but like half white, half Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's the one who becomes very committed to the Chinese communities. You know, she did a lot of journalism in Chicago and Seattle, and wrote a lot of short stories about the Chinese in these places. So Asian American studies traditionally has liked that sister more.
Oh.
And so the other sister is the chameleonic sister, Winifred Eaton, who took on a Japanese pen name as Onoda Watana, which means something like to fake a name.
Right.
Right. So she's already very playful in the way she thinks about it.
Right.
And then she writes books about Japanese women and like romance novels that to our time would feel very Orientalist and semi-racist.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just reading one the other day and I was like, yeah, I still feel that way. But if you read her alongside a lot of the Orientalist writing at the time, Madame Butterfly and those kind of things, you see that she's really reversing a lot of those
playing
with it, exactly, a lot of tropes that she's trying to play around with, and she was way more popular in her own time than her sister, and so part of Viet's argument in that book is that, you know, we've only really been able to see the one sister as as like Asian American politically, really been unable to kind of deal with this other one, the trickstery chameleonic one. And so that got me thinking from the very beginning, you know, when I was an undergraduate, how to answer that question.
Right.
You know, what do we do with them? And because them is kind of similar to the way I was brought up.
Right.
Right. So what, when Viet asked that question, I'm thinking, what do I do about myself in that way?
Right. And that seems to be part of the resistance to being labeled an ethnic writer. You know, that the only way you can really be an authentic ethnic writer is to fit within a certain box or another. And that seems to be also kind of part of the political discourse that your book is intervening into, you know, you know, like this, even this term Asian American, you know, is kind of justified by this idea that, you know, America or North America are these kind of multicultural societies. Could you speak more about, you know, the way that you're kind of trying to critique what, you know, many people consider to be a good thing?
Yeah. So I throughout the book, I call this pluralist governmentality, right? And so I name this as a kind of form of governance that I see shared through from colonialism in Southeast Asia, at least British and American colonialism. And similar to cultural pluralism in the US, which was happening around the same time, but didn't really take over the US. But it becomes more similar to multiculturalism and then global multiculturalism today. So we would recognize it more as just global multiculturalism,
right?
In the way that racial identities are kind of, like you said, they're kind of treated like these boxes that we check. But so, I mean, in a lot of these novels, the acts of transition of taking back identity and trying to reinvent it in a way are in direct response to forms of multiculturalism or pluralist governmentality, where the state has the state and then eventually global capital, as we see in a lot of these narratives.
Right.
But beginning with the state and the colonial state is very interested in trying to convince people to that they are part of these groups, partially because they are diasporic and that makes them not belonging quite with the nation as much as others. And then eventually this becomes a more full-on, like, I guess, inclusive tactic where everyone's included in the nation.
Right.
And then the state just kind of appears as this neutral umpire force, benevolent force, right? And as long as that diversity remains, then the state can kind of get away with a lot.
Right.
So a lot of it, this was, became more entrenched during like the Cold War and the scares of communism, as a way to respond to, you know, Marxism and communism, people calling for equality, And that this was a kind of equality of a different sort, Diversity was a kind of equality, and a kind of virtue that then could be exported abroad, from when it reached the U.S., from the U.S. to other places. So I try not to be like too cynical about, because I've, like so many people of color have benefited quite a lot from multiculturalist institutions, diversity programs, grants, and those things would not be there were it not for some of the work that was done, like, you know, so-called cultural wars of the 80s and things like that. But I'm also trying to resurrect the kind of de-imperializing, like decolonial politics that now we seem to assume leads to multiculturalism. Whereas I'm arguing actually that those politics would kind of see multiculturalism as a governing force.
Could you explain that in greater detail? How does multicultural? Okay, so multiculturalism is a governing force, and then also how it's kind of part of, you know, the justification of imperialism abroad. So how is it that, you know, this kind of American North American exceptionalism to say that, oh, we are so multicultural, so therefore we have, you know, a certain sort of exceptional quality about us that leads us to have a civilizing mission elsewhere.
Yeah. And that's kind of the double play of it.
Yeah.
I guess that inside the nation, it appears, like I said, to valorize the state or to make it appear neutral in a lot of ways. But I mean, I'm getting a lot of the term from Foucault, that he talks about disciplinary forms of power. And biopolitical power. And so these identities are then disciplined into a kind of submission. And I talk about this mostly in chapter three, but that how these identities that are then incorporated and accepted are also split into like the tolerable forms and the intolerable forms. The kinds that are like that incorporate well and the kinds that don't incorporate well. And usually the ones that don't incorporate well are kind of lost, or then they're kind of thrown back into the darkness of like unknown identities. We don't know what they are. Let's not deal with them.
The others.
Yeah, exactly. And so that there's always this kind of double sidedness, to multiculturalism. And the text that I look at, sorry, I didn't really answer your text question either.
It's okay. We got plenty of time.
But you know, they get through this, they articulate this very, very well, which is one reason I was attracted to them. The first book that I talk about in my book is Scorpion Orchid, and just that name, Like it's about how like for Lloyd Fernando, who wrote it, colonial pluralism, the colonial state had this kind of looked like an orchid from afar, you know. But once you try to pick it or you try to think to get deep into it, there's a scorpion down there. And so he's using this very, very figurative language to think about the kind of double play of this kind of governing force, that it actually extends inequalities in a lot of ways, that it also creates these like others, intolerable others. And so that's the domestic side. And then the, like you said, the more imperial international side is that it becomes an exportable good. And it becomes a kind of civilizing mission that we see very much alive today with countries in the Middle East that we are constantly led to believe are very intolerant. And that's our best excuse for why they are our enemies and adversaries.
Can you tell us a bit more about this kind of decision to use this label Trans-Pacific Anglophone Literature? And how does that kind of build into the critique that you're, or this critique of multiculturalism that you're making?
Yeah. I mean, part of it, like I said, when I did my exams in graduate school, it was like 200 books, let's read them all. And they're all, let's, you know, for now, let's just call them migrant and diaspora literature.
Right. The eternal problem. How do I label it?
Exactly. And then, of course, very quickly, I realized that diaspora does not really fit into how to understand these texts. They're not really about the homeland and the host country at all. Right. And that's the way I see the kind of paradigm of diaspora.
And diaspora deserve to be at home.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Deserves to have a home of some sort, at least. But it's not my home, the diasporic home. And I mean, this is partially, again, from my own upbringing, where like I didn't even know that the majority of my family was Filipino until I was like 14 or 15.
Wow.
But then when I found that out, you know, in a traditional diasporic narrative, that should mean everything to me.
Right.
You know, it did mean something, but it didn't mean everything.
You know? Mean you didn't go back to the Philippines and rediscover yourself?
Not right away. Not right away. It took a while. You know, it was really cool for me. I loved learning about the Philippines. Right. I have been there quite a few times. But I did find that narrative kind of pushed upon me that I'm supposed to now think of this as my roots space and everything.
Yeah.
And it just didn't really make sense to me. And then people would read that as a kind of betrayal, I suppose. And so it was kind of going through that and then seeing again how all these other authors felt that way, you know, when I read them and that they understood what this was and that it wasn't just this kind of refusal to go along with a certain politics, but it was actually very political in itself. And so diaspora then didn't work, basically. Right. So I had trans-Pacific studies, trans-Pacific modes of thinking now have been more popularized in through Asian American studies authors.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm taking this from like Denise Cruz and Martin Jo Ponce and others who write books that are, you know, have diaspora throughout, but they also seem to kind of push a different kind of angle, like a more trans-Pacific angle.
Mm-hmm.
And then Anglophone, I'm getting obviously from just the word Anglophone, but it's also the most troubling, I think, term of all the terms that I use.
Definitely.
It's the one I get asked questions about the most. And I really understand why, because a lot of people from these areas that I'm talking about, from like Malaysia especially, do not like the term Anglophone. Yeah.
Well, why? Could you tell us more?
Because they don't want to be seen as just trying to mimic England, you know?
Right.
And that's the way they see that term. And world English is the preferred way of speaking about it. But then I just basically have to convince them I'm not using it that way. I'm not saying that you're mimicking these people or that these books are doing that. And so I'm very much influenced by Shumaisha's use of Sinophone, where she uses that term to kind of talk about non-Han Chinese, both inside and outside of mainland China. Mm-hmm. But part of the purpose of that term isn't just to separate those, but to offer a more complex, like heterogeneous form of Chinese-ness that then upsets global multiculturalism.
Yeah.
Right? So part of her target is actually global multiculturalism. We have the same, similar, a similar project there. And so Anglophone, I feel to me, does a similar thing of taking a lot of these kind of like leftovers from different canons and putting them together and being able to read them without relying on diaspora as a paradigm, but trying to read them as the kind of inauthenticity that they express in the same way that I guess Shumaisha does, except I'm trying to do it by bringing Southeast Asia and like the politics of these writers to a more American politics.
Right.
So that we can start to see American multiculturalism as a form of pluralism, pluralist governmentality.
That is part of what Trans-Pacific offers is it requires that there a Trans-Pacific comparison be conducted. So how is it that then what happens when you take, you know, what normatively would be considered Asian American literature and you label it Anglophone? What does that do for the sort of cultural politics?
Yeah, that's always a good question because I don't think they're either or, you know.
Right.
Asian American literature can also be Anglophone. Doesn't always have to be. And so this is one thing I've had to kind of figure out as I was writing the book in a very pragmatic form where, you know, you write your introduction, you know, here goes your methods, here goes your archive. Trans-Pacific Anglophone is kind of both method and archive in a way, which kind of makes it a bit confusing, I suppose. So it's both the archive that we talked about, but it's also a kind of a method, right? And so in my my third chapter, I look at two Asian American texts, one of them quite canonical, Peter Bichot's Cebu.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been read as Asian American or Asian Canadian mm-hmm. texts mm-hmm. for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look at them and I read them as Anglophone texts. And basically that means asking, what if we read this as not authentic identities,
right?
As if they were not ethnic, as if they were not intimate subjectivities of right. this type of ethnic personality.
Right.
What if we read it as if they were like doing something different, as if they right. were like more distanced from these main right. characters
right.
or they were kind of trying to make fun of them a yeah. bit or trying to like put them as figures to critique or to think about.
Not a form of autoethnography.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I also found, you know, I was not the only person who thought these texts were like this, you know.
Yeah.
Even the author, like Peter Bichot himself,
mm.
In my conversations with him, has told me he's always been upset the way this book was received.
Mm.
And then I showed him my work on his book, and he just said he really liked it. So I assumed I got it more right than other people by reading it more as a kind of, like, I wouldn't say cynical, but more as a kind of stage play, in a sense, about the Filipino American, rather than being an authentic representation of one.
A chameleonic reading.
Yeah. Let's just put it that way. Chameleonic Anglophone stuff.
Hmm. Well, how does this aporia, you know, in, you know, or this kind of less attention paid to the kind of transnational nature of Asian American studies, how does that relate to multiculturalism?
There's a lot of ways to answer that question. Right. And I think that, like, the sections of the book, I think, are kind of devoted to three different ways. One is through the history, like we talked about.
Mm.
You can't really get away from the imperial history. And you can't really get away from how America has relied on forms of diversity and multiculturalism to incorporate people who might otherwise, you know, be factioning in some
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there's the historical point of view, but there's also the mobility point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that every time one travels or moves, these identities are kind of exposed.
Right.
You know, and this can be advantageous for the kind of inner workings mm-hmm. of pluralism, in the sense that, you know, one can travel to a different country and then come back and only think of themselves as more American,
right.
you know, because they had been there and that place is just the opposite. It's intolerant, right? It's
right.
Uncivilized or something. And then it kind of reassures us that, you know, we are different. We are the Asian Americans. We're not the Asians,
mm.
you know? And so there's this whole, like, we don't want to be confused with them, that we see in a lot of Asian American literature as well, that gets expressed in a lot of interesting ways. And so there's this reaches a lot of different, dynamics. So the third way is more in the kind of genre,
mm-hmm.
like we discussed a little bit before, in the sense that we only seem to recognize texts
mm-hmm.
that are about that identity,
right.
you know, and that seek to kind of represent it in an authentic way, empower it,
right.
you know, something that's, again, like, very important, especially when you haven't seen those identities of power, you know, in those positions before,
mm-hmm.
But also one that doesn't really have an end to it, in the sense that there's always going to be people excluded from that, and the kind of pain that we all go through of not belonging is still going to exist, you know, even after seeing those images or seeing those representations. You know, for me, what's interesting about those representations of, like, you know, someone like Bruce Lee or something like that, mm-hmm. you know, it gave me a lot of empowerment and strength when I was growing up to finally see some, you know, something like that. But what was interesting about that to me was that other people that I could talk to shared in those feelings, mm-hmm. you know? But then it also created other types of hierarchies, identities
yeah.
that then, later, you know, as I became, like, more effeminate, I suppose, suddenly I didn't fit into that. And then the pain was there again, you know?
Yeah.
And so there was always kind of this reaction to it by just finding the next identity or being
yeah.
the empowerment was just going to yeah. kind of come back.
Transitory.
Yeah.
Okay. So far we focused a lot on, you know, theory, concepts, cultural politics, but I feel like maybe this conversation, we're not really getting to one thing that's really important. I felt in your book is that you're also articulating that these books have great artistic merit.
Mm.
I think that's something that really shines through in your writing is, you know, there's an admiration there for these writers and the kind of the ways that they express these ideas, but also the kind of artistry that they bring. And also not just how the narratives are about people who subvert identity, but how the books themselves and the ways the texts are written also kind of play with categorization in order to kind of, you know, bring about something new, as if there's almost a sort of modernism to it.
Yeah, and I feel like I got lucky in the sense that I chose an archive because I read some books of that archive, and I could just sense that there was a greatness to it, that there was a kind of artistic, and a type of artistry to it that I couldn't figure out the terms for. Like I said, I could not canonize them. And, you know, like you take a post-colonial literature class, you're probably not going to read any Filipino literature, any Malaysian or Singapore literature. Or if you take a diaspora class, you know, very similar, or even an Asian American studies class, you're going to read very little of it. And so part of it was kind of this project of trying to share what I appreciated with other people, you know, that these literatures spoke to me in a very intimate way. And trying to share that and figure out what is this, you know, it's not post-colonial, it's not diasporic. What is it? And that, you know, then getting repeatedly frustrated at how these were all literatures that were very easily dismissed and ignored, you know, because of this, because they were difficult to read, difficult to kind of figure out, you know, where to put them in the academy.
Don't fit that easy check mark for box.
Exactly. You know, I try not to make this ranty in the book. I can go on rants forever about how people don't read this or it gets ignored, especially Filipino literature, which has been around for a long time. And, you know, the Philippines is the third largest English speaking country in the world. They've been writing in English for a very long time. And a lot of the books are just fantastic. And it's been very difficult to articulate why they're fantastic when you can't put it into post-colonial or some other recognizable form. And so a lot of the books, like you're saying, is trying to get a kind of canonical form or something that allows us to read them and understand that these are not, this is the project that they're interested in. It's not the projects that we've been interested in so far, but it can actually speak more to us than we might think. Speak more about American Empire. Speak more about global multiculturalism today than we might think. So part of the project of the book that I'm really happy about is to just share those texts with the world and to be able to kind of name a form or name some themes and tropes that are common in them that allows us to appreciate them and allows us to figure out what the artists are trying to say.
What are any particular themes or tropes that you think stand out or kind of easy to describe in pithy statements made for podcasts?
Pithy. Well, first of all, I end the book on this, like that, that I see them as a type as speculative. And then I hint at this throughout the book that every text I look at is not quite real. And, you know, that it kind of, it's messing around with time, magical realism, things like that. And so there's this other register that's not the ethnic autoethnography that we were talking about. But it's a type of speculative register. You know, and that register means that they're a bit distant from the characters, that they're not exactly trying to inhabit themselves, you know, but at the same time, it doesn't make it any less intimate, I suppose. You know, so like the word Fernando, when he was writing Scorpion Orchid, according to him, stared at himself in the mirror and would just say, "I'm not a racist. I'm not a racist."
I do that too.
No, we all do that. But that was because he was writing from different points of view. You know, like, so he was writing a book that where there was a South Asian. He was South Asian, so there was a South Asian in the center of that book. But it did use, like, it broke with different narratives, right? It went through different types of people, and to do that was pretty radical for his own time, right? And the fact that that's one of the very first Malaya texts to come out of that that context, I think, is really interesting and names a lot of what's happening. And you get the same thing with a lot of the Filipino literature, and even the diasporic one, like Jessica Hagedorn, is writing from these multiple points of view. It's really hard to tie down a kind of authentic voice. And so I read them as speculative, as a way to show that these are that they're writing from a position of inauthenticity, basically. That if you, the reader, are coming to this, all you're seeking is a ethnic autobiographic voice, you're going to be very disappointed.
You want to fill your multicultural checkbox.
These books will not allow you to do that. Exactly. They're going to disrupt that checkbox as much as much as they can. So that's exactly part of the value of them, I think. That they disrupt all those boxes.
now that you've had some time to reflect on this book and, you know, it's come out and you've worked on new things, you know, how do you think it sort of speaks to the present moment?
Yeah. Which present moment is that?
Good question, I guess.
I mean, is it the Trump moment?
I don't know. Or, you know, this kind of era of, you know, strongmen. You know, and it just seems to that we're living in a sort of blowback moment of anti-globalization or re-entrenchment of nationalism that even though that seems to be the discourse, you know, like maybe the wool's being pulled over our eyes in a certain sense too.
Yeah. I mean, I always try to take the more like Foucauldian cop out, which is to say, you know, like terrible things have happened in the world because philosophers make predictions. And I'm no philosopher, so I'm not even going to go that far. But when Trump was elected, we could just start there. The first thing that went through my mind, which might be the mind of some readers when they first pick up the book, is like, oh, he's talking about the Obama era. He's talking about this figure who relied on notions of diversity, who was like everybody's president, you know, and multiculturalism. And at the same time, you know, drone bombings just catapulted right during Obama's tenure.
Mm-hmm. And deportations.
Deportations, you know, that empire was basically the black eye of that whole administration in so many ways. And yeah, like most of the book was written under Obama. And I thought that too when you know, Trump was first elected. And then I took some time to think about it. And I realized, you know, there's parts of the book and parts of these theories that are actually more about Trump than I would have ever guessed. And I think it goes back to that double-sidedness of multiculturalism. Yeah. You know, like with Obama, you kind of saw the orchid side. You saw the nice, creamy top, you know. Mm. I think now we're starting to see... and even, you know, with the, like the police shootings and things like that, it was already there. But now we're starting to see much more the kind of terrifying scorpion-laden bottom of multiculturalism, which is that, you know, if you accept these identities as real and that they're everything, you know, how do you know what you are? Like, I know I'm Asian because I'm not white or because I'm not black or because I'm not Latino. And then those identities are there for you to contrast yourself. Right. To them, which means that they are not part of the us, you know, most and then they are your contrast, they are your adversaries, they're your enemies,
it almost
potential enemies.
It also kind of, I mean, this is, I'm being speculative here, but it seems to kind of raise this discourse too, you know, if multiculturalism is about making sure that every box gets ticked in the kind of multicultural identity, then doesn't the kind of Trump resurgence, you know, of white nationalism also kind of indicate a sort of, we should also have our box checked as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is why Manium saw the chameleon as so important. Because that worldview presumes that these are real. Yeah. These identities are like real. Like, yeah. They're there, you know. And that's the only way, you have to accept that really before you can accept what you just said.
Yeah.
Right. That now it's our turn. It was their turn. Now it's our turn. It's already that kind of, you know, oppositional thinking that, for Manium, at least, and you know, in his time, was reinforced by these kind of tiger entrenchments, you know, and that this is why the kind of the fakeness of the inauthenticity was such a threat to that, because those were the first ones that kind of had to be dealt with, right?
So, how has your fiction writing been affected, or in a sort of reciprocal way, affected, you know, your academic work, you know? Like you are, you know, you could be considered a trans-Pacific Anglophone writer, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I talk about my writing career a bit over the very early or whatever my writing career has been as an artist so far, publishing in both obscure and non-obscure journals. Yeah, but I mean, I try not to say that I am trans-Pacific Anglophone as a writer, because it's really hard to think of myself as an artist when I'm in scholarship mode.
Mm-hmm. But maybe that's part of your transitioning.
Yeah. And I write under the pen name Kavika Guillermo, like you said, and, that in itself has been really interesting, because my mother told me when I was about the same age, she told me I was Filipino somewhere around that same time. Well, you know, I have a lot of family members in Hawaii, and they all have really, like, what I thought at the time was like really cool names, you know, like Kanakini, you know, Camilla. And so I was like, these are really cool names. Like, why didn't I get a name like that, you know? And so my mother basically said, oh, yeah, I was going to give you a name like that. You were going to be called Kavika. Like, that's the name I planned out for you. And then she's like, okay, you know, but I didn't give it to you. And she didn't really explain why. And I didn't really feel like I had to ask. It was pretty common sense, I think, when she told me, because we had moved from Hawaii and we're living in the widest big city in America, Portland, Oregon.
Right.
And we were like the only, my brother and I, and my sister were like the only like brown right. kids, like people of color in our neighborhood. Right. So yeah, name him Chris. like don't give him this like very effeminate, you know, ethnic name. Right. Mm. So I don't blame her at all for doing that. But ever since she told me that, I like took on that name. And so even with it, when people call me Chris, I still feel like they're calling me Kavika, and because those names are kind of similar, it kind of works a bit that way. Mm. But I use that name, you know, anytime I'm not physically talking to somebody. Oh. So like when I'm on the internet, when I'm playing video games, when I'm traveling, actually, yeah. I would introduce myself as Kavi or Kavika. And so, so I've taken on that name in a lot of different guises, and it's become a very intimate part of me. Mm. And I started publishing fiction under that name, partially because I just thought, you know, the scholarship got my legal name, fiction will get this name, you know, just because I wanted to kind of split and make sure it was fair to both sides of me. And then I started, and then funny things started to happen. Like, I got this email about a year after I took on that name as a fiction writer from this guy who like wanted to work with me. Mm-hmm. And he had seen that I had published under a pen name, because I'm very open about it. I don't try to like, you know, and then he sent me an offer that was like, co-write this novel with me. Mm. And the character is it's an ethnic autobiography about a Amish woman coming of age, leaving her Amish community and going to New York City. Mm-hmm. So he was like, you're gonna have to do a lot of research, and we're going to write it together and speak under the same pseudonym, which was like Ava Troyer, something like that. And so we were going to both fake this. He wasn't Amish either, right?
Right.
So we were both going to fake this poor Amish girl.
Right.
And man, that made me so uncomfortable. When I got that email, I was like, you know, I kept asking him questions because like, I just wanted to know, like, is this something everyone does? Like, what other ethnic novels have I read that was actually by like two like people pretending?
It's like talking to a con man, and it's like, you know that this is a con, but you want to hear more.
You want to hear more. Exactly. Like, can you tell me like how you get up in the morning? And you know, this is always a conversation in literary, in literature, you know, like how far, especially like white people can take using like ethnic characters and pseudonyms and things like that. And I realized that by using this pen name, I had been kind of one of them in a way.
Oh.
People thought I was one of them.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. And so like, I talk about this a bit in the sixth chapter where, you know, I'm talking about speculative fiction and that this is the way I've overcome this kind of disconnect, I suppose, with the reader to try and explain myself a bit better is by writing in this like speculative mode.
Right.
So I don't think anything I've written has really been ethnically like authentic autoethnography in any way. And so I try to write always in the same register, the speculative, even if it's, about something real or it's in a realist mode, there's always something kind of distancing about it.
Mm-hmm.
So as an artist, I kind of had to take on that persona a bit more, as a way to think through, my own artistry and how I present myself. So yeah, I had to kind of come up with these my own strategies, like transitive strategies.
Like a double consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Transitive consciousness in Freire's terms.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us more about the kind of your current academic trajectory? Cause you're moving into different, different academic fields, or what are you working on now academically?
So for my future work, well, right now I've been engaged with game studies quite a lot. As you mentioned, like there are a lot of kind of not so much theorizations, but a lot of playing with ideas of play throughout the book.
Right.
I see games as kind of as also functioning within imperial dynamics across the Trans-Pacific.
Yeah.
In the sense that for like video games, so much of the genre of every game genre comes from Japan or is so influenced by Japan that what we think of as video games now is just such a Trans-Pacific cultural object.
Absolutely.
So that's part of what I'm really interested in. I'm interested in how like play can also bring out different forms of identity, you know, and can kind of reinforce the body, you know, so like video games, unlike a lot of like literature and film, I would argue do not really work on identity in the same way, you know, that like for Stuart Hall, films were kind of a perfect way to depict identities, or that was one of the main points of films, right? That you communicate with the protagonists in some way, that their identity is like is kind of the crux of the film. Video games don't really do that. Like you're playing like this like stereotypical Italian plumber named Mario, you know, I don't think any part of you is like, oh, Italy is empowered, you know. And so video games are just so much more embodied and much more about sensation. And so I think there's something there that's fascinating. And, you know, of course some games work with identity. But I think those are very cinematic, and those are they're very conscious of what they're doing, you know. Whereas the vast majority of games, in a sense, allow us to think in different terms. And so it is part of my kind of search for like alternative ways of living in our bodies, and that I think games allow us to do.
That's so interesting. Well, thank you, Chris, for your time, and thanks for telling us more about your book and also, you know, your interesting fiction work and your new research. That was really great, and I look forward to reading more of your future work. So,
thank you. It is totally my pleasure, as has been my pleasure to host this podcast and other episodes.
Yeah. So, thanks again.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye. Thanks for listening to my interview with Chris Patterson on his book, Transitive Cultures, Anglophone Literatures of the Trans-Pacific. If you have any questions, grievances, or suggestions for books for this podcast, you can message the New Books in Asian American Studies Facebook page. Thanks.